Chapter 10. Matters of Trust. Breakout. False Flag.
Don't run, snarled Grawl. They see you running and they'll know.
Bay shot him a narrow-eyed look from beneath her forage cap.
This isn't running. Believe me, you'd know if it was running. This is a purposeful walk.
He snorted and clamped a hand around her arm, forcibly slowing her down.
Well, dial it back to a meander. Look casual.
Grohl glanced around at the marketplace stalls as they passed through them.
Look like you want to buy something.
At their side, Pasri made a face.
Buy what, exactly?
Asked the ex-soldier, her scarred nose wrinkling. Well, she had a point. Most of the stalls were bare, abandoned by owners who were either too afraid to leave their homes or lacking for produce to offer after the nobles had instituted martial law and imposed checkpoints on all the out-of-city highways. Bay couldn't help but glance over her shoulder. In the distance, what had once been a precinct tower for the capital's regiment of Adeptus Arbites was now wreathed in thin smoke. The crossed-out imperial aquila on its southerly face was visible through the haze, and the harsh croaks of police sirens wafted towards them on the wind.
Don't stare, Grohl snapped.
You want us to blend in?
She replied.
Everyone else is staring.
Not that there were many people around. The few daring to venture out onto the streets of Dagonet's capital kept off the rubble-strewn roads or minded their own business. No one assembled in groups of more than four, fearful of the edicts that threatened arrest and detention for anyone suspected of gathering for reasons of sedition. Bay almost laughed at the thought of that. Sedition was the act of treason against an existing order, and if anything, she, Grohl, Pasri, and the handful of others were the absolute antithesis of that. They were the ones championing the cause of rightful authority, of the Emperor's rule. It was the noble clans and the weakling governor who were the rebels here, rejecting terror and siding with... Her eyes flicked up as they passed into a crossroads. There on the island, in the centre of the highway, a statue of the War Master stood untouched by the street fighting. He towered over her, standing tall, with one hand reaching out in a gesture of aid, the other holding a massive bolter pistol upwards to the sky. Bane noticed with a grimace that votive candles and small trinkets had been left at the foot of the plinth by those eager to show their devotion to the new regime. Grohl paused at the intersection, rubbing at his thin beard, his eyes flicking this way and that. Finally, he made a choice.
Over here.
Bay and Pasri followed him across the monorail lines towards an alleyway between two shuttered storefronts. She managed not to flinch as a patrol rotorplane shrieked past over the rooftops, klaxons hooting.
It's not looking for us,
Pasri said automatically. But in the next moment, Bay heard a change in the aircraft's engine note as it circled, looking for a place to put down.
Are you sure about that?
Grohl swore. This entire operation had been a cascade of errors from start to finish. Firstly, the man who was meant to drive the GEV truck did not arrive at the rendezvous, forcing them to improvise with rods and ropes to hold down the steering yoke and throttle. Because, of course, Grohl would never have considered sacrificing himself for the cause on a target so ordinary. Then, at the approach, they found the barricades placed by the Klanner troops had been moved, making their straight shot at the precinct doors impossible. And finally, as the payload of crudely cooked chemical explosives had at last detonated in a wet blast of noise and light, Bay saw that the damage it inflicted on the building was superficial at best. She had at least hoped they could escape the security dragnet, but if they were captured, their failure would be total and complete. Bay knew that the patrol flyers carried nine-man teams with cybermastiffs and spy drones. The first icy surges of panic bubbled up in her chest as she imagined the interior of a dank interrogation cell. She would never see Capra again. Grohl broke into a run, and she followed him with Pasri at her heels, listening for the metallic barks of the enhanced dogs. He slipped through a gap between two waste skips and down towards a side road. Ahead of him, a woman in a sun hood and sarong stepped out from a doorway and looked up at them. Bay was struck by the paleness of her face. Dagonet's bright sunshine tanned everyone on the planet's temperate zone, which meant she was either a shut-in noblewoman or an off-worlder, and neither were likely to be seen in this part of the inner city.
"Pardon,"
she began, and her accent immediately confirmed her non-Dagonetti status.
"If I could trouble you."
Grohl almost missed a step, but then he pressed on, pushing past the stranger.
"Get out of my way,"
he growled. Bay came after him. She heard the yelps of the mastiffs in the distance and saw Pasri looking back the way they had come, her expression unreadable.
"As you wish,"
the woman said, spreading her hands. Bay saw the glint of metal nozzles at her wrists, just as she pursed her pale lips and blew out a long breath. A vaporous mist jetted from the nozzles and engulfed them all. The ground beneath Bay's feet suddenly became the consistency of rubber, and she stumbled, dimly aware of Grohl doing the same. Pasri let out a weak cry and fell. As Bay collapsed in a heap, her limbs refusing to do as she told them, she saw the pale woman smile and lick beads of the spray off her fingertips.
"It's done,"
she heard her say, the words drawing out into a liquid humming echo. Bay's senses went dark. The acrid chemical stink of smelling salts jolted her back to wakefulness, and Bay coughed violently. Blinking, she raised her head and peered at the room she found herself in, expecting the pale green walls of an Arbites cell. Instead, she saw the gloomy interior of some kind of storehouse, shafts of daylight reaching down through holes in a sheet-plus roof. She was tied to a chair, hands secured behind her back, ankles tethered to the support legs. Grohl was in a similar state to her right, and past him, Pasri looked back at her with an expression of tight fear. Grohl met her gaze, his face a mask of rigid, forced calm.
"Say nothing," he told her. "Whatever happens, say nothing."
"Right on schedule," said a new voice. "As you said."
"Of course."
That was the pale woman.
"I can time the actions of my toxins to the second, if need be."
Bay focused and saw the woman in the sarong talking with an odd-looking youth wearing what looked like some form of combat gear. He was working a device mounted on his forearm, a gauntlet that grew a flickering hollow screen. Both of them glanced at their prisoners, for that was what they were, Bay realized belatedly, and then passed their heads. She heard motion behind her, and Bay sensed someone standing at her back.
"Who's there?"
she said, before she could stop herself. A third figure moved around the captives and came into view. He was tall, clad in a black oversuit with armor patches and gear packs. A heavy pistol of a design Bay had never seen before hung at his hip. He had a hawkish face that might have been handsome if not for the hardness lurking in his gaze.
"Names," he said.
Grohl made a derogatory sound deep in his throat. The youth with the wrist device sniffed and spoke again.
"Lya Bay, Terek Grohl, Olo Pasri."
"The nobles have files on all of you," said the hawkish man. "We took these copies of their database on the resistance when we destroyed the Kappa 6 communicatory."
"You did that?"
said Pasri.
"Shut up," Grohl snarled. "Don't talk."
Bay kept silent. Like the rest of them, she'd been wondering just what had happened at Kappa 6 ever since the news feeds had announced the cowardly, treacherous attack by terrorist militants a few days earlier. In the end, Capra had suggested that it was either the work of an independent cell they weren't aware of, or just some accident the nobles had decided to blame on them.
"We're nothing to do with those resistance radicals,"
insisted Pasri.
"We're just citizens."
The youth sneered.
"Please don't insult my intelligence."
"Things are going badly for you, aren't they?"
said the man, ignoring the interruption.
"They're getting close to finding your hideaway. Close to finding Capra and all his cell leaders."
Bay tried not to react when he said the name and failed. He turned to her.
"How many of your people have surrendered in the past few weeks? 50? 100? How many have taken the offer of amnesty for themselves and their families?"
"It's a lie,"
Bay blurted out, ignoring Grohl's hiss of annoyance.
Those who give up are executed.
Of course they are, said the man.
He nodded towards the youth.
We even have Picts of the firing squads.
He paused.
Your entire resistance network.
Such as it is,
said the youth with an arch sniff.
Your network is on the verge of collapse,
continued the other man.
Capra and his trusted corps of freedom fighters are the only things holding it together. And the nobles know that all they really need to do is wait.
He walked down the line of them.
Just wait until you run out of supplies, of ammunition, of hope. You're all exhausted, pushed beyond your limits, angry and tired. None of you want to say it, but you all know it's true. You've already lost. You just can't admit it.
That was enough for Grohl to break his own rules.
Go screw yourself, Clanner bastard!
The man raised an eyebrow.
We're not... Clanners, is it? We are not in the employ of the nobles.
He leaned down and pulled something from the neck of his armor, an identity disc on a chain.
We serve a different master.
Bay immediately recognized the shape of an Imperial sigil tag, a bioactive recognition device gene-keyed to its wearer. An etching of the two-headed Aquila glittered there on its surface. It could not be forged, duplicated, or removed from the person of its user without becoming useless. Anyone wearing such a tag was a soldier in service to the Emperor of Mankind.
Who are you?
Pasri was wary. The man indicated himself.
Kel, these are Tariel and Solm. We are agents of the Imperium and the Authority of Terra.
Why tell us your names?
Hissed Grohl. Unless you're going to kill us.
Consider it a gesture of trust, said the pale woman. We already know who you are, and in all honesty, knowing what to call us hardly makes you a threat.
Bay leaned forward.
Why are you here?
Kel nodded to Tariel, and the youth produced a molly knife. He moved to where Pasri was sitting and cut her loose, then proceeded to do the same with Grohl.
We have been sent by the Emperor's command to aid the planet Dagonet and its people in this time of crisis.
Bay was certain that she saw a loaded look pass between Solm and Kel before the man spoke again.
We are here to help you oppose the insurrection of Horus Lupercal and anyone who takes his side.
Grohl rubbed at his wrists.
So, of course you'd like us to take you to the secret retreat of the Resistance, introduce you personally to Capra, open ourselves up so you can murder us all in one fell swoop.
He turned his head and spat.
We're not fools. Or traitors.
Tariel cut Bay loose and offered a hand to help her to her feet, but she refused. Instead, he gave her a data slate.
You know how to read these, correct? Your file says that you served the Administratum as a datum clerk in the Office of Colonial Affairs prior to the insurrection.
That's right, she said.
Tariel indicated a text file in the slate's memory.
I think you'll want to look at this document. And please check the security tags so you are sure it has not been tampered with.
Kel walked closer to Grohl.
I believe you when you say you're not a traitor, Terek Grohl. But you have been fooled.
What in Star's name are you talking about?
Snarled the other man.
Because there is a traitor in this room,
Kel went on. And then, faster than Bay's eye could follow, the Imperial agent's hand flicked up from his belt with the blocky, lethal-looking pistol in its grip, and he shot Pasri dead through the heart at point-blank range. Bay let out a cry of shock as Grohl started forward. Tariel tapped the slate.
Read the file,
he repeated.
And then search your good friend, Olo,
added Solm. Grohl did that as Bay read on. By the time she had finished, the colour had drained from her cheeks, and Grohl had discovered the wireless listening device concealed on the other woman. The files, as Tariel said, unaltered from their original form, were reports from the Clanners about an informant in the Resistance. Capra had suspected they had a leak for some time, but he hadn't been able to discover who. According to the last entry, Olo Pasri had agreed to give up the location of the main freedom fighter safe zone, but was stalling for a larger finder's fee and the guarantee of passage off-world. All of this she told to Grohl, who listened with a stony, rigid expression. After a long moment, he spoke.
"I don't trust you," he said to Kel. "Even this, you could have faked it. Did it all just to get close to us."
"Grohl,"
Bay began, but Kel held up a hand, silencing her.
"No, he's right. Given time and effort, we could have engineered something like this. And if I were in your place, I would share your suspicions."
He paused again, thinking.
"So then, we need to earn your trust."
"A demonstration,"
suggested Solm. Kel nodded.
"Give us a target."
Spear ran his hand up and down the arm of the Grox leather chair where he sat, guiding fingers moulded in fleshy echo of Hissos's body over the lustrous tanned hide. The sensation was pleasing. It made him realise he had spent too long in quietus, denied the simple pleasures of awareness, allowing his consciousness to go dormant while the mind ghost of Yosef Sabrat ran his flesh. Puppet and the puppeted, master and performer, their roles intermingled. He was tired of it. At least now he had only to look the part, rather than literally become it. He glanced up and saw a reflection in the glass cabinet behind the desk of High Reeve Katatelamak, the ebon face of Hissos staring back at him. Telamak swiveled in her deep wing-backed chair from the watchwire console on her desk and replaced the bulky handset. Standing nearby, like an overweight sentinel, the doughy figure of Reeve Warden Bertz Lehmner was uncharacteristically still. Spear imagined he was still trying to process all the possible outcomes of the revelation that Yosef Sabrat was the serial killer in their midst, looking for the results where he would come off best. He felt a particular kind of hate for the man, but when he concentrated on the shape of it, Spear could not be certain if it had originated in him or in Yosef Sabrat. More than once, the Reeve's own temper had brushed against the killers, and in those moments threatened to awaken the dormant murderer. He sucked in a breath and dismissed the thoughts as trivial, refocusing on Telemach, who sat glaring at the vine paper documents before her.
"How could something like this happen in my precinct, under my governance?"
she demanded. Typical of the woman, Spear thought. Her first consideration was not how could this tragedy have happened, or a good man like Sabrat a killer, impossible. No. For all the death and bloodshed and fear that had swept across her city, her first impulse was to worry about how it would make her look. Telemach glared at Lehmner.
"Well?"
We never suspected for a moment that the killer could be a peace officer."
The High Reeve was about to spit out something else, but Spear intervened. In Hissos's voice, he said,
"In fairness, how could your men have known, milady? Sabrat was a decorated member of the Centine with over a decade of service under his belt. He knew your procedures and protocols intimately. He knew all the loopholes and blind spots."
Lehmner nodded.
"Aye, yes. I have teams from the documentary office going over everything in his caseload, back years and years. They've already found incidences of file tampering, evidence manipulation."
All of which Spear had been planting little by little over the last few weeks. Very soon they would discover more killings that he had laid at the late Reeve's feet, from the deaths of minor citizens to shopkeepers, and even a junior Jaeger from this very precinct. Every one of them Spear had murdered and impersonated for brief periods of time, working his way up to this identity, step by step.
"It was only a matter of time before he was caught,"
Spear as Hissos went on, and he tapped the evidence bag on the desk that contained the harvesting knife.
"I've encountered these kinds of criminals several times. They all become careless after a while, convinced of their own superiority."
Telemach grabbed one of the more gory pics of the murder scene at the air docks, waving it at him, and Spear resisted the urge to lick his lips.
"But what about all this?"
She jabbed at the beautiful perfection of the eightfold sigils drawn in the blood of the dead.
What does it mean?
He sensed the edge of fear in her words and relished it. Yes, she understood the common, squalid manners of death, when humans ended one another over trivialities like money and power, anger and lust. But she could not conceive of the idea that one might take life in the name of something greater, to appease something. Spear wanted to tell her. He wanted to tell her that her insect's-eye view of the cosmos was pathetically naive, blind to the realities that he had been made privy to at the Delphos on Davin, and later at his master's hand. He made Hissos's face grow grave and concerned.
Sabret wasn't alone in all this. His cohort, Segan. They were a partnership.
That fits the facts, said Lamna. But I'm not sure why Yosef killed him.
A disagreement, offered Spear.
All I know is the two of them conspired to get me alone with them at Whiteleaf. Then I was forced to watch as Sabret ended Segan's life before he tried to do the same to me. I almost... At this point, he gave a staged shudder.
He almost killed me, too, he whispered.
And the symbols?
Telemach asked.
These were ritualistic murders.
He paused for the drama of it.
What do you know of this group called the Theoge?
He had barely said the word before the High Reeve's face split in a sour sneer.
Those throwback religionists. This is their doing.
She shot a look at Lamna.
I said they were part of this. Didn't I say so? I knew it.
Spear nodded.
They are some sort of fundamentalist cult, if I understand correctly. It seems that Daeg Segan was the go-between for the Theoge, and in turn the murders committed by Sabret with his help were likely motivated by some twisted set of beliefs.
Human sacrifices, said Lamna.
On a civilized world like this?
This is the 31st millennium, not primitive prehistory.
Telemach answered immediately.
Religion is like a cancer. It can erupt without warning.
For a moment, Spear wondered what great hurt in the woman's past had occurred because of someone else's belief. Something scarring, no doubt, to make her hate any thought of such things with that undiluted venom.
I would advise you move against this group as soon as possible, he went on, getting to his feet. Your media services have already learned of some elements of this case. I imagine those involved with the Theoge will quickly become targets for vigilantism.
Lamna nodded.
Sabrat's wife and child have already been attacked. I sent Skelter to the house. He said they were hounded and stoned.
Find out if they were involved,
Telemach insisted.
And by nightfall, I want every single Theoge suspect on the books hauled in for questioning.
Spear drew himself up, smoothing down the front of Hissos's tunic in a reflexive gesture copied from the operative's own muscle memory.
I see you have everything in hand. You have my report. I will take my leave of you now this matter is concluded.
Lamna shook his head.
But wait! There are proceedings. Testimony to be made, a tribunal. You will need to remain on Iesta to give statements.
The Void Baron does not wish me to stay.
All it took was a look from Hissos's eyes to the High Reeve, and she buckled immediately.
Of course, operative,
she said. The thought of defying Eurytas or one of his agents never occurring to her.
If any questions arise, a communique can be sent via the consortium. We caught the killer. That's all that is important.
He nodded and made for the door. Behind him, he heard Lamna speak again.
The people will feel safer, he said.
It seemed less like a statement of fact and more like something the man was trying to convince himself of. A brief smile crossed Spear's changed face. The fear that he had unleashed on the streets of Iesta Veracrux would not be so easily dispelled. Guido Ruffin was enjoying the difference in things. Before, Back when the governor was still kowtowing to terror and the nobles did nothing but grumble, Ruffin had been destined to remain a low-ranked non-commissioned officer in the Dagonet PDF. His life consisted largely of shirking his responsibilities, such as they were, and putting his workload on the junior ratings unlucky enough to be under his supervision at the vehicle pool. Since the day he had enrolled, after a Justicar gave him the choice between Borstal or service, Ruffin had never looked back to civilian life, but in all that time he hadn't been able to shake the longing for a day when he could wear a coveted officer's braid. It didn't occur to him that his general level of ignorance outstripped any small measure of ability he had. Ruffin was simply unable to grasp the idea that he had never risen in rank because he was a poor soldier. He was a make-weight in the city garrison, and everyone seemed to know it but him. To hear Ruffin talk, it would seem like there was a huge conspiracy among the senior officers to keep him down, while other men were promoted up the ladder, men that he considered less deserving, despite copious evidence to the contrary. But Ruffin wasn't one to let facts get in the way of his opinions. He was snide and demeaning to the back of every man who wore the braid. He amused himself by scribbling anonymous obscenities about them on the walls of the barracks washroom, dragging his heels over every order they gave him. This and a dozen other petty revenges. It was because of that Goeda Ruffin was in the office of his commander when the liberation took place. That's what they were calling it now, the liberation. The bloody day of upheaval that left Dagonet declared free of imperial rule and true to the banner of the War Master, Horus. Ruffin had been there, waiting, forgotten. He had been there for a disciplinary review. Someone had heard him bad-mouthing his superiors one time too many, and if it had just been any other day, he would likely have ended up dismissed from the PDF for his troubles. But then the shooting started, and he saw soldiers fighting soldiers in the courtyard. Warriors from the palace garrison, their uniforms marred by crossed-out Aquila sigils, cutting down all the men he never liked. He was hiding in his commander's office when the officer came running in, barking orders at him. At his heels were a pair of the palace men, and seeing them, Ruffin at last caught up to what was going on. When his commander bellowed at him to come to his aid, Ruffin took up the ornamental dagger the man used as a letter opener and stabbed him with it. Later, the leader of the invading troops shook his hand and offered him a marker with which to scratch out his own imperial emblems. He got his officer braid because of that, and all the men who surrendered with him took it too. That, or the buzz of a las round to the back of the head. After the dust settled, the new regime needed officers to fill the ranks they had culled. Ruffin was happy to accept. Emperor or War Master, he didn't give a damn whose name he had to salute. He had no respect for any of them. Ruffin left the motor pool behind. His new command was the Emergency Circumstances Security Camp, established on the site of the Capital Terminus monorail station. Ever since the nobles had shut down the networks, the passenger trains had lain idle. But now they had a new duty, serving as prison accommodations for the hundreds of civilians and idiot rebels who had dared to defy the new order. Ruffin lorded it over them, walking back and forth across the high gantries above the choked platforms, making sure each inmate knew he held the power of life and death with random beatings and executions. When he wasn't exercising his dull brutality and boredom on them, Ruffin was prowling the ammo stores on the lower levels, in what used to be the maintenance wells for the engines. He liked being down there, among the smells of cordite and gunmetal. It made him feel like a real soldier to be surrounded by all that firepower. Entering the observation cupola above what was once the station's central plaza, he caught the watch officer sipping a mug of black tea and gave him a glowering stare.
"Status!" he barked.
The officer looked at his chronograph. "Check in at the top of the hour, sir. That's another quarter turn away." He had barely finished speaking when the intercom grill over their heads crackled into life.
"Ernie," said Ruffin.
"Control," said a panicked voice over the vox. I think there might be a problem." "Post two, say again," began the watch officer, but Ruffin snatched the handset from him and snarled into it.
"This is the base commander. Explain yourself."
"Recruit Zager just... well, he just fell off the south wall, and Tormor isn't responding to his wireless." Then, very distinctly, the open vox channel caught a sound like a quick, low hum, followed, a heartbeat later, by a wet chug and then the echo of a body falling. Ruffin thrust the handset back at the watch officer, uncertain what to do next. "Shall I try to raise the other guard post now, sir?" said the other man, stifling a cough.
"Yes,"
he nodded. That sounded like the right sort of thing.
"Do that."
Then, without warning, the old control board, left intact from the station's prior function, flickered into life. Lines of colour denoting tracks, blocks of illumination signifying individual carriages, all began to click and chatter as they activated. Ruffin shot a worried look out of the windows of the cupola and heard the mutter of dozens of electric motors coming alive. The sound echoed around the vaulted glass spaces of the station concourse and platforms. Below, the prisoners were scrambling to their feet, energized by the sound. Ruffin drew his pistol on impulse and kneaded the grip.
"What's going on?"
he demanded. The watch officer looked at the consoles before him in surprise.
That's not possible," he insisted, coughing again. "All remote operations of station systems were locked out. The hard lights were severed."
He swallowed hard, beads of sweat appearing on his high forehead.
"I think someone's trying to move the traits."
Below, the ornate copper departure boards for all the platforms began whirring in a rattling chorus of noise, each one flashing up destination after destination. With a sharp report, they all stopped at once, all of them showing the same thing. End of the line. The prisoners saw the words and let out a ragged cheer. Ruffin shouted abuse back at them and caught sight of one of his men running up the platform with a heavy autogun in his grip. The trooper was perhaps 20 meters from the jeering prisoners when his chest exploded in a silent red blossom and he fell. Finally, the correct words registered in his mind.
"We're under attack!"
When Ruffin turned back to the watch officer, the man was lolling in his chair, eyes and mouth open, staring blankly at the ceiling. He caught a strange floral smell emanating from the officer and gingerly extended a hand to prod his waxy, damp face. The watch officer slumped forward, knocking his tea glass over. The flower stink grew stronger as the liquid pooled on the floor. Ruffin's hand flew to his mouth.
"Poison!"
Without looking back, he ran to the cupola door and raced away, footsteps banging off the metal gantries. Spear reached out a hand and rubbed the edge of the ornate tapestry between Hissos's thick fingers. The complex depiction on the hanging was of the Emperor smiting some form of bull-like alien with a gigantic sword made of fire. He rolled his eyes at the banal pomposity of the thing and stepped away, carelessly brushing fibers of broken thread from his hands. Touching the object was forbidden. But there was nobody here in the audience chamber to see him do it. The killer idly wondered if the residue left by the demon's skin of his flesh cloak would poison and shrivel the ancient artwork. He hoped it would. The idea of the humans aboard the Ayuba running about and panicking as the piece blackened and corroded amused him no end. He glanced out of the viewing windows as he wandered the length of the chamber. The curve of Iesta Veracrux was slipping away beneath the starship's keel as it turned for open space, and Spear was not sorry to see it go. He had spent too long on that world, living in the inanities of its civilization, play-acting at a half dozen different roles. Since his arrival, Spear had been many faces, among them a vagrant, a storeman, a streetwalker, a Jaeger, and a Reeve, living the lie of their ridiculous, pointless existences. He had stacked their corpses, and all the others, to make the ladder that led him to where he now stood.
A few more murders. One, perhaps two more assumptions.
And then he would be close to the mark. The greatest prey of them all, in fact. A shiver of anticipation rippled through him. Spear was eager, but he reined the emotion in, pushed it down. Now was not the time to be dazzled by the scope of his mission. He had to maintain his focus. Before, such a slip might have been problematic. He was convinced that such thoughts were how the psyker wench, Perig, had been able to gather a vague sense of him down on Iesta. But with her no more than a pile of ashes in a jar in the Yuba's chamber of rest, that threat was gone for the moment. Spear knew from Hissos's memories that Baron Eurytas had spent much influence and coin in order to bend the Imperium's fear-driven rules about the censure of psychics. And, given the present condition of the Consortium's welfare, that would not be repeated. The next time he met a psyker, he would be prepared. He smirked. That was something unexpected, he pulled from the operative's ebbing thoughts. The Void Baron's secret. And the explanation for the shabby appearance of his agency's compound on Iesta. For all the outward glitter and show the merchant clan put on for the galaxy at large, the truth whispered in the corridors of its ships was that the fortunes of Eurytas were waning. Little wonder, then, that the clan's master was so desperate to hold on to any skein of power he still had. It made things clearer. Spear had known that sooner or later, if he murdered enough members of the Eurytas staff and made it look like Sig was the killer, the Baron would send an operative to investigate. He never expected him to come in person.
Matters must be severe.
Spear halted in front of the red jade frieze and reached out to touch it, tracing a fingertip over the sculpting of the warrant of trade. This place was full of glittering prizes. Of that there could be no doubt. A thief in Spear's place could make himself richer than Sin. But the killer had his sights set on something worth far more than any of these pretty gewgaws. What he wanted was the key to the greatest kill of his life. The hubris of the rogue trader irritated Spear. Here, in this room, there were objects that could command great riches if only they were brought to market. But Eurytas was the sort who would rather bleed himself white and eat rat meat before he would give up the gaudy trappings of his grandeur. As if thought of him was a summons, the doors to the audience chamber opened, and the Void Baron entered in a distracted, irritable humour. He shrugged off his planetfall jacket and tossed it at one of the squad of servitors and human adjutants trailing behind him. "Hissos!" he called, beckoning. Spear imitated the operative's usual bow and came closer.
"My lord, I had not expected your shuttle to return to the Yuba until after we broke orbit."
"I had you voxed,"
Eurytas replied, shaking his head.
"Your communicator implant must be malfunctioning."
He touched his neck.
"Oh, of course. I'll have it seen to."
The Baron went for a crystalline cabinet and gestured at it. A mechanism inside poured a heavy measure of wine into a glass goblet, which he snatched up and drank deeply. He gulped it down without savouring it.
"We are done with our visit to this world,"
Eurytas told him, his manner veering towards a brooding sullenness.
"And it has taken our dear Perig along the way."
He shook his head again and fixed Spear with an accusing glare.
"Do you know what she cost me? A moon, Hissos. I had to cede an entire bloody moon to the Adeptus Terror just to own her."
He walked on across the mosaic floor. The cabinet raised itself up on brass wheels and rolled obediently after him. Spear searched for the right thing to say.
"She had a good life with us. We all valued her contribution to the clan."
The Baron turned his glare on the vanishing planet.
"The governor would not stop talking," he said. "They wanted our fleet to remain in orbit for another week. Something about helping to stimulate the local economy."
He snorted with derision.
"But I have little stomach for the festivals they had planned.
I walked out on them. More important things to do. Imperial service and all that. Spear nodded thoughtfully, deciding to feed the man's mood.
The best choice, my lord. With the situation as it is in this sector, it makes sense for the clan to keep the flotilla moving. To be in motion is to be safe.
Safe from him? Eurytas took another drink. But the bastard Warmaster is killing us by inches, even so. His voice went up. Every planet he binds to him costs us a weight in throne guilt that we cannot recover.
For a moment, it seemed as if the Baron was about to give voice to something that might have been considered treasonable. But then he caught himself, like a man afraid he would be overheard, and his expression changed.
We will head for the edge of this system, and then make space to the rendezvous point at the Arrowhead Nebula.
Spear knew already what their next port of call would be, but he asked anyway,
"What will our intentions be there, Lord?"
We will lay to wait to assemble the clan's full fleet, and while we are there, meet a ship from Sota. Aboard there are a party of remembrancers under the Emperor's aegis. I will personally take them home to Terra, as the Council has requested.
The security of the remembrancers is of great concern, said Spear.
I will make all arrangements to ensure their safety from the moment they board the Uber to the moment we bring them to the Imperial Palace.
Eurytas looked away.
I know you'll do what is required.
Spear had to fight down the urge to grin. The path was open, and now all he needed to do was follow it all the way to the end, to the very gates of the Emperor's fortress.
No!
The voice crackled in his ears like breaking glass, and Spear jerked, startled.
No! No! No!
The Baron did not appear to have heard it. The killer felt a peculiar twitch in his hands, and he glanced down at them. For one terrible moment, the skin there bubbled and went red before shifting back to the dark shades of Hissos's flesh. He hid them behind his back.
No!
Then the echo made the origin of the sound clear. Spear let his gaze turn inwards, and he felt it in there, moving like mercury. Sabrat! Until this moment, Spear had believed the purgation that the idiot Reeves cohort interrupted had gone to plan. But now his certainty crumbled. There was still some fraction of the stolid fool's self hiding in the shadowed depths of the killer's mind, some part of the false self he had worn that had not been expunged. He pushed in and was sickened by the sense of it, the loathsome, nauseating morality of the dead man staining his mind. It was bubbling up like bile, pushing to the top of his thoughts, a scream of recrimination.
Hissos?
Eurytas was staring at him.
Are you all right, man?
No!
No.
Spear coughed out the word, his eyes watering, and then with effort took control of himself once more.
No, Lord,
he went on.
A moment of fatigue, that's all.
With a physical effort, the killer silenced the cries and took a shuddering breath.
Ah.
The Baron approached and gave him a kindly pat on the shoulder.
You were closest to the Psyker. There's no shame in being affected by her loss.
Thank you,
said Spear, playing into the moment.
It has been difficult. Perhaps with your permission I might take some respite.
Eurytas gave him a fatherly nod.
Do so. I want you rested when we reach the rendezvous.
Aye, Lord.
Spear bowed again and walked away. Unseen by anyone else, he buried the nails of his hand in his palm, cutting the waxy flesh there. But no blood emerged from the ragged meat. Ruffin found another intercom panel on the station's mezzanine level and used it to send out an all-posts alert. But if anything, he became even more afraid when the only men that reported back were the ones at the armory. He told them to hold the line and started on his way to them. If he could get there before any of the terrorist attackers did, he could open the secure locks and drag out all the big lethal weapons that he had been so far denied the chance to use. There were autocannons down there, grenade launchers and flamers.
He'd give these loyalist bastards a roasting for daring to cross him. Oh, yes! Descending an enclosed stairwell, he caught sight of the western platforms. Monorails there were filling with prisoners, each one closing its doors and moving off seemingly of its own will, carrying the inmates to freedom. The first few to go had ploughed through the barricades across the lines. Now there was nothing to stop a mass exodus. Ruffin didn't care, though. He would let them go, as long as he could keep the guns. Reaching the lowest levels, he found the men at the first guard post were gone. In their place, there were piles of clothing and lumps of soggy ash, illuminated by the flickering overhead strip lights. The air here felt cold and oppressive, and Ruffin broke into a run again, propelled from the place by a cold pressure that was like a shadow falling over his soul. He turned the corner and ran towards the armory post. Six men were there, and all of them were pale and afraid. They saw him coming and beckoned frantically, as if he were being chased by something only they could see.
"What happened back there?"
he snapped, turning his ire on the first man he saw.
"Talk, rot you!"
"Screaming," came the reply. "Oh, sir, screaming like you ain't never heard. From Hades itself, sir."
Ruffin's fear bubbled over into anger, and he backhanded the man.
"Make sense, you fool! It's the terrorists!"
At that moment, the floor below them exploded upwards, the iron grid plates spinning away as a hulking figure burst out of the conduits beneath. Ruffin saw a grinning, fanged skull made of tarnished silver, and then a massive handgun. A single shot from the weapon struck one of the guards with such force it blew him back into another man, the velocity carrying them both into the curved wall where they became a bloody ruin. Ruffin stumbled away as the dark shape blurred, releasing an inhuman snarl. Gunfire sang from the weapons of the guards, but it seemed to make no difference. There were wet, tearing noises, concussive blasts of bolt fire, the dense sounds of meat under pressure, breaking and bursting. Something whistled through the air and hit Ruffin in the chest. He went to his knees and slumped against the wall, blinking. Like a blood-painted dagger, a broken human femur, freshly ripped from a still-cooling corpse, protruded from his chest. Ruffin vomited black, sticky spittle and felt himself start to die. The skull-faced figure came to him, trembling with adrenaline, and spat through the grill of the mask.
"Oh, dear," it rumbled. "I think I broke him."
Ruffin heard a tutting sound, and a second figure, this one more human than the clawed killer, hove into view.
"This is the base commander. We needed him to open the ammunition store."
"So?" said the skull face. "Can't you do your trick?"
"It's not a parlor game for your amusement, Eversore."
He heard a sigh, and then a sound like old leather being twisted. Through blurry eyes, Ruffin saw his own reflection. Or was it? It seemed to be talking to him.
"Say your name," said the mirror face.
"You know who I am,"
he managed.
"We're Goeda Ruffin."
"Yes, that's right."
Now it sounded like him too. The mirror face drifted away towards the locking alcove near the heavy iron hatch that secured the ammo stores. It was impregnable, Ruffin remembered. The built-in security cogitator needed to recognize both his features and his vocal imprint before it would open. His face and voice.
"Goeda Ruffin," said the mirror.
And with a crunch of gears, the armory hatch began to swing open. Ruffin tried to understand how that could be happening, but the answer was still lost to him when his heart finally stopped. The rendezvous was a spur line outside a storage depot in the foothills, several kilometers beyond the capital. Under Tariel's guiding hand, the simple drive brains of the monorails had obeyed his command and cut fast routes through the network that confused the PDF spy drones sent to follow them. Now they were all here, emptying their human cargoes as the sun set over the hillside. Kel watched the ragtag resistance fighters gather the freed people into groups, some of them welcomed back into the fold as lost brothers in arms. Others formed into parties that would split off in separate directions and go to ground, in hopes of riding out the conflict. He saw Bay and Grohl moving among them. The woman gave him a nod of thanks, but all the man returned was a steady, measuring look. Kell understood his position. Even after they had done what he had charged them to do, and obliterated a major stockpile of turncoat weapons into the bargain, Grohl could still not find the will to trust them.
"Because he's right not to," said a voice in his thoughts,
a voice that spoke with his sister's words. The rebels believed Kell and the others were some kind of advance unit, a scouting party of special operatives sent as the vanguard of an imperial plan to retake Dagonet in the Emperor's name. Like so many things about the assassins, this too was a lie. A man in a hood emerged from the midst of the rebels and said something to Bay. But it was Grohl's reaction that gave away his identity, the sudden jerk of the severe man's head, the tensing of his body. Kell drew himself up as the man came closer, drawing back the hood. He was bald and muscular, with a swarthy cast to his skin, and he had sharp eyes. The Vindicare saw the tips of complex tattoos peeking up from his collar. Kell offered his hand.
Capra.
Kell. The freedom fighter took it, and they shook palm to wrist.
I understand I have the Emperor to thank for this.
He nodded at the trains.
And for you.
The Imperium never turns its face from its citizens, he replied. We're here to help you win your war.
A shadow passed over Capra's face.
You may be too late. My people are tired, few scattered.
He spoke in low tones that would not carry.
It will be more a service to help us find safe passage elsewhere. Let some of us come back with the reprisal force as tactical advisers.
Kell did not break eye contact with the rebel leader.
We did this in a day. Imagine what we can do together in the days ahead.
Capra's gaze shifted to where the rest of the execution force stood, waiting silently.
Bay was right. You are an impressive group.
Perhaps
with you at our sides there is a chance.
More than a chance, insisted Kell. A certainty.
Finally, the man's expression changed, the weariness, the doubt melting away. In its place, there was a new strength, new purpose. He wanted so badly for them to be their salvation, Kell could almost taste it. Capra nodded.
The fate of Dagonet rests with us, my friend. We will not forsake it.
No,
he said, as Capra walked away, gathering his men to him as he began to rally them with firebrand oratory. But the rebels would not know the truth, not until it was too late, that the fate of Dagonet was only a means to a single end, to place the arch-traitor Horus between Aristide Kell's crosshairs.